Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, for the first time in a minute, we'll admit. This is the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of collecting films in obsolete formats. You can also think of this podcast as mostly being about films from the VHS era, though we don't necessarily watch them on VHS.
Right.
And our film for this episode is definitely a VHS-era film that maybe had a second life as a rental, maybe?
Maybe.
Maybe for creeps. Their film is called The Crush from 1993, and we watched it on Laserdisc, getting it from the exchange in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, and we paid 10 whole dollars. 10 American dollars for this film.
I mean, you know, it was 90s nostalgia, I thought.
It was 90s nostalgia, and apparently there's a reason why a film of this quality is $10, and we'll get into that in the podcast. It's rarity. We have a rare edition of The Crush. Yeah, let's get into this film. I guess I should explain the plot.
Yeah. So it's supposedly based on a true story.
Okay.
And Alan Shapiro, who wrote and directed the film, based it on his experiences of renting an apartment over a garage, which is how the movie starts.
Yes.
A writer decides to rent an apartment over a wealthy family's garage, and he meets Darian, the 14-year-old daughter of the parents, and she has a crush, hence the name, on him, and the crush does not end well.
Yeah, it doesn't end well. Sorry, I didn't realize that when you said based on a true story, I thought it was something not involving the writer.
No.
That adds a whole layer of creepiness and uncomfortableness.
And he was the one who cast Alicia Silverstone
at the age of 15.
Well, she was probably 14. I'm assuming she was 14
when she was cast.
But she became legally emancipated at 15 so that she could do the filming hours that were required for it. So he cast.
Yeah.
A 14-year-old
in this Lolita vixen. This movie is an attempt at making Lolita meets Fatal Attraction.
Maybe a little Demon Seed in there.
Maybe a little demon seed in there too,
yeah.
But yes, this female crush obsession 15-year-old.
Well, they were 14-year-old in the film when they met.
14-year-old in the film when they met.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, we just got to get into it, is so highly sexualized. And while there is no nudity in the film, in that sort of classic rated R sense.
You see her butt cheeks. You see a butt.
You see a butt that you hope is a body double.
Yes.
And it probably is a body double, because Hollywood is not real, but we're still talking about the body double playing the part of a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
There's a bikini scene and a close-up to the lower half of that bikini scene as he's being a voyeur looking through the blinds down at her. This movie is so cringe. This movie would be high camp.
This movie would not get made today.
This movie could not be made today.
And if it was made today, everybody would be canceled.
Yes, everybody would.
Everybody affiliated with the film would literally be canceled at this moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, now granted, even then, I wonder if people, the critical reception back in 1993 probably was not great. I mean, in fact, looking at the Laserdisc album sleeve in my hands, there is no front cover, critic rave, there's no two thumbs up, no I loved it quotation marks, Roger Ebert. No, the only thing they can do that's positive on the back is scary, stylish, and very sexy. A top-notch thriller from Jim Saveda from KNX Radio. And when, let's face it, if the only positive critic review you have is someone you then have to Google to make sure they're a real person,
yeah,
you gotta scrape. You're scraping at that point.
So on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 27% rating.
Who are the 27% of people who like this film?
But here's my favorite review of Hal Hinson of the Washington Post. There's something scuzzy about the whole exercise, and I think that's the best way to
say it. Yeah, no, it is infinitely scuzzy because, and part of, not only do you then have a 15-year-old playing a 15-year-old. I mean, you think about it, if it was made today or if you tried to make this film today, you would cast someone over 18.
Yeah.
You would cast a 19 or a 20-year-old who looks young.
Yeah.
No, no, no. They cast a 14, then 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Who looks old.
Yes. Well, they made her look mature through makeup, hairstyle.
And made her, yes.
And as well as dress, right?
Yeah, like, as well as dress, as well as outfits, as well as there is a very bizarre scene that quotes a scene from Blue Velvet where he's hiding in a louvered closet and watching her undress. And there is this, I mean, part of the weirdo gender politics is he is, throughout the film, the victim.
100%. And we should also mention his character. So, I guess the hard part for people, it's Cary Elwes, who, if you love Princess Bride, you always want to see him in these very, like, positive, charming roles. And he's very scuzzy in this film. He's also, the character is also 28. And so it's a 28-year-old. Yeah. And also they make the point of referencing that he's 28.
Yes.
And that she's 14 when he first meets her.
And he's an accomplished, sophisticated, professional writer who is beyond stupid.
Yes.
He's profoundly stupid throughout the film.
Yeah.
Which also is, I think, for me, an interesting... Like, again, you know... So we use this phrase, you know, camp or kitsch on this podcast a lot. And I think we have to go all the way back to Susan Sontag and talking about how camp is sincerity that failed.
Right.
And part of what makes this film, you know, so weird and so strange and so bad, but also so very cringe, is that, yes, they were trying to make a Brian De Palma film in an era when Brian De Palma was seen as a master filmmaker, whereas anybody's, my students' names, anybody under the age of 30 probably has no idea who Brian De Palma even is.
Exactly.
And that's okay, because Brian De Palma's not good. He was like...
Maybe they watched Carrie.
Maybe, yeah. Watch Carrie.
Yeah.
But you probably don't think, oh, that's a Brian De Palma film.
Exactly.
Whereas there was a time when we were very young people, a Brian De Palma film was a big deal.
Right.
Anyway, so they were trying to make a Brian De Palma, and Brian De Palma really, okay, so for those of you who don't know, if you might be under 30 watching this, listening to this podcast, it's Brian De Palma is... The dollar store brand Hitchcock.
Yes.
That's what he was. Yes. It was dollar store Hitchcock.
Bad production values.
Bad production values. But because he used those devices, there was such a literariness or something to his films that was perceived.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
And if you didn't know Hitchcock, you would assume...
Or even if you did. I mean, you think somebody like, you know... You can go back, and sometimes we do for these podcasts, go back and read, like, Roger Ebert reviews and stuff. Some of the few missteps in history that that man committed was loving Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was of that sort of psychological thriller film. But one of the other things that's super wrong about this film, and you really catch it, I think, seeing it in the 2020s. So there's a total lack of exposition. Mm-hmm. It goes from zero to, oh, he's renting a place. Oh, this girl's weird. This girl is also trying to be attractive and cute and engaged and whatever with him. Ah, there's no pacing. It telegraphs its punches. And for someone who has a job, who has earned a job as a writer at a supposedly major, super important magazine because he's so smart and talented, he is so incredibly stupid.
He, like, never locks his door.
He never locks his door.
So the one of the early...
I'm speechless.
One of the early scenes in the film... so, you know, she's develops a crush on him. She pops into his apartment because he leaves the front door unlocked all the time. And he's in the shower. And he leaves the door cracked with himself in a towel. And what an idiot. Like, that's like your first sense of, like, he is so
dumb. Because you need this. And there's this one scene where there's the female gaze.
Yeah.
Or is it male exhibitionism?
Right.
Where you see his butt or his body double's butt. And it goes from there. He never locks the door.
Yeah.
He never locks the door to his apartment. Ever.
And then he's also alone with her.
A lot.
A lot.
And lets himself be alone with her a lot. Invites her in.
Yeah.
Talks in a charming, friendly way. They go for a car ride together at night.
Right. And he gives her, he kisses her.
Yes.
And so he also is inviting her into his life. And then when she gets confused about boundaries, she's the bad one.
She's the crazy bitch.
And she's 14.
And
so, as all of us who went through awkward crushes in our preteen and teen years, we have all mistaken people being kind or understanding or nice as, like, oh, maybe this person likes me. And so that's where this happens. It's really gross.
It's really gross.
That he invites her into his life. He doesn't shut down her coming into his apartment all the time, her just flirting and joking with him all the time. He doesn't shut it down until way past when it was appropriate to shut it down.
Yes.
And she, as you mentioned, she's the crazy one in this situation.
Yes.
And he's, again, as you mentioned, he's a 28-year-old, sophisticated, well-known writer. Why would he be hanging out with a 14-year-old in the first place?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And he has, and actually, so the way of them trying to mitigate the cringe is that there is a photographer at the magazine and she has a crush on him as well. So you see him flirting. Mm. So you're like, oh, no, he's really only interested in women his age. But as you, there's also the scene where he watches her undress while he's hiding in the closet.
Because he goes into their house. Into her house. And no one's home.
Yeah.
And just wanders upstairs.
Yes.
He just wanders upstairs and then realizes and wanders into a teen girl's room. Looking for things.
And there's this scene where he sees something under her bed and he pulls it out with his foot and it's a pair of her underwear. And it's gross, right? Because he wants to look at a 14-year-old's underwear. And instead of, like, so he hears in the bathroom, instead of trying just to leave and slip down the hallway quickly, he decides to stay in the room and then decides
to hide in the closet.
And then Blue velvet style. He makes a noise. He knocks the hangers. So she realizes that he's in there. And so she turns around to show. And gives him a smile.
Yes.
Right? So, and that also, you know, their way of trying to mitigate the cringe. Well, she liked it. She wanted it. She gave him this
She
smile.
Was asking for it.
She was
asking for it. Like, sort of, you know, and that's the thing, like, And again, for this guy who's actually a classical music DJ to say it's very sexy.
Yeah.
You have to wonder, like, who's the audience for this film? Who's the filmmaker apologizing for this? You know, his own actions or his own, like... I mean, it is that very Augustinian, St. Augustine-esque, I should say, or Augustinian, I don't know, Augustinian idea of sexuality where it is almost this punishment. And, like, for men to be attracted or aroused is this, oh, I can't control ourselves or something. It plays on that so heavily.
Yeah.
And is why this film is so cringe and so ugly. And so are people renting... Did people see this movie? Are people renting this movie? Or the 27% of people who liked it?
Right.
You know, is there a weird cautionary fantasy element of this film?
Yeah. So the year before Poison Ivy was released with Drew Barrymore. And like a very similar... This fatal young girl, fatal attraction with the father of her friend.
Yeah.
So very similar. And you have, so that did well, you know, Poison Ivy did well. So I'm sure it's like, oh, let's greenlight another film like this that'll do really well. He is the victim throughout the whole film. He is portrayed as the victim of this.
Her lack of self-control. Her overtly sexual nature.
And she ends up accusing him of rape.
Which is a whole other, like, in terms of male fantasy nightmare.
Yeah.
Victimhood.
And then, of course, of today, of, you know, her best friend realizes she's lying and doesn't believe her. And so you think about, like, you know, how many women have been silenced around rape and not reporting it because of how our culture is. And then yes. This is just like, by the way, they might be lying to get at you.
Yes.
And of course, he ends up being redeemed at the end because it turns out she has a diary where she documents everything. Her friend knows she's lying. And then
Dad... And he lands the absolute perfect Michael Jordan is not this athletic punch that sends her flying into a soft pile of rags in the attic. Which, by the way, there's a carousel in the attic of this house. The dad rebuilt an entire carnival carousel, in the attic of the house.
We should also mention they have a mansion. Like, they have a massive house. It didn't need to go in the attic, but yes, there's a full running carousel.
That was rebuilt in the attic. How did it get up there?
Well, he mentioned it. He pulled it up piece by piece.
Piece by piece, and then it could never leave, and it also did not make the house, the weight did not make the house sag or collapse. So there's that incredible, like, plot logic thing.
Yeah.
There is also, I'm sorry if we're spoiling this for you, but don't watch this movie. Don't watch this movie so we can spoil everything. There is a scene where he finds beneath his apartment a shrine dedicated to him, which I wonder, I didn't think about this, like where that sort of piece of visual vocabulary comes from.
Yeah.
That someone would have a secret shrine and the person would discover it and it would be so creepy. Could it possibly be from this crappy film? The one redemptive thing. So he goes down the trap door from his apartment into the garage that he's living above, and he finds a room full of candles and pictures of him.
Yes.
And he does not move out immediately.
He doesn't take, like, a photograph or call the parents.
He doesn't take a photograph of it.
And say, come now, like, you have to see.
You have to see there's something very wrong.
Yeah.
He doesn't even blow out all the candles that have been lit and were just burning. He just, like, okay, I'm going to nail the door shut to the trap door to the shrine dedicated to me. And then I'm going to, with fire happening underneath where he sleeps. And then I'm just going to move on with my life and try to still write the big story for the magazine. Who also, this super demanding boss who's British because, of course, stern people are always... Stern, smart people are always British. If you don't know how to make a character stern and smart, make him sound like Patrick Stewart. And who, yeah, there's so many characters in this film that are just like, they're not characters, they're just devices.
Right.
Everybody in this film is a device.
Yeah.
Alicia Silverstone's character, Darian, which we have to talk about Darian.
Yes.
And why this is a $10 laser disc, not the $3 exchange laser disc, because
the Alan Shapiro, the writer and director, used the actual girl's name that he based the story on. So this girl who had a crush on him while he was renting an apartment from her parents, he actually used her first name. And so the family sued for libel, which rightfully so. And he was forced to change it in any future films and now had become Adrian. And so we actually have a Laserdisc copy that still has the original name.
Says Darian right on there, and it says Darian right on in the film.
You will see Darian on like the on Wikipedia because that was the original name. But yeah, so they were forced to change it to Adrian after that, because idiot who does that. I think the other thing about the film, so like for, you know, obviously like his impression of this girl in real life, and he felt the need to use her name, was that she was capable of like harming him because the crush went too far in some aspect. So the story's not fully true. It doesn't end that way.
Yeah, like no one gets almost killed.
But I think
she almost kills his love interest out of spite or out of jealousy.
And she
in this really contrived way.
She also injures her best friend
and then kidnaps her best friend. And
so the thing, though, that they keep doing is, Alan keeps doing, is trying to make her seem much more mature than her years. So she mentions that she skips 2 grade levels. So she would have been, instead of 8th, 9th grade, she would have then been in, like, 10th or 11th grade. So he's trying to then make it seem like she was an older high school student by saying she skipped grade levels. She, the very beginning, she's like a pianist.
She's super smart in so many ways. She rewrites one of his articles.
And it's better. She collects insects. She maintains this diary. She's an equestrian. And so they keep doing these things to make her seem wise and more mature beyond her years. But what we know in terms of psychology is that even if a child is still smart, they still have to go through child development, right?
Yes.
And so that emotional regulation, understanding boundaries, that's still a process that children have to go through. They even mention when she gets her period, so that you know that she's a woman now.
Yes.
She's had her period. So she is ready to be married off or to have children. She's had her period. So they routinely just do these like cringe things to justify the story and to justify that she's crazy, but she's 14, you know, and it's just a very bizarre, gross kind of thing.
Yes.
And as we were watching it, I turned to you and for me, it always feels like people get Lolita wrong, right? The Lolita is really about how creepy the writer is, and that he's unreliable narrator. He's obsessed with her, and she hasn't done anything to warrant that particular obsession. And it's almost like this film is like, no, but it's from the guy's perspective. What if the girl really was crazy? And, you know.
Yeah, what if she just was so insistent about being attracted to him and he just couldn't resist?
Exactly. And that's like what it comes down to. And so, like, Lolita is supposed to be about him being gross, right? That he is a pedophile, that he is attracted to younger women. And he marries Lolita, or Dolores's, which is her real name, Dolores's mom, so that he can spend as much time with her as possible. And so now you're taking the situation, and it is, he's 28 years old, Nick can't resist her, she keeps pushing herself on him, and he's justified in all of his actions. But at the end of the day, it's really a girl who's confused by these weird boundaries that he's allowed to be overstepped. And we both work in education. And so for us also immediately, it's like, ew.
There's so much ew. It's one of the things that sometimes when we watch a bad film, at least I know I find myself thinking about, well, how could this have worked? How could you have made it good?
Yeah.
How could you have made this film work? I don't... You know, if there's one or two scenes that were different, or you had a better actor in that role, or the plot... I don't think there's any way this film could have ever worked.
No. No.
The major premise is too weird, too bizarre. And yeah, just the chronic ick factor of a sexualized child.
Yeah. And this 28-year-old
man. 28-year-old man who should know better, or should enforce boundaries, or should lock his door, or when they find the shrine, should move out immediately, is repeatedly victimized and re-victimized by this child.
And the film ends, so no one... So the funny thing about this is that it's supposed to be a thriller, it's supposed to be a horror movie, and it, like, does not work on any of those levels. And... No one dies. There's no gore.
Yeah.
There's no... Beyond butt cheeks, there's no nudity. Right. Thank God, right? I wouldn't want to see. But there... So... But the way it ends is that she's now writing him. And so he gets his mail. He's living now with the photographer. And she hands him a pile of mail, and you just see him flipping through letter after letter, after letter from
and Darian. She becomes then, she starts getting attracted to her doctor.
Right, her psychologist.
And the psychologist in the hospital, who also, she'll never learn, she's a psychopath. Right.
And he looks very similar to Nick.
And he looks very similar to Nick, which is also, again, the complete, and this is kind of a Brian De Palma film thing, and this film being a discount Brian De Palma film,
right,
that there is this vague sense of psychology, and that psychology is a thing, you know, people just do stuff that's not rational. And that
there, however, was not a diagnosis.
But it's clear that she's crazy. She's psycho. And that becomes then the shortcut. You don't actually have to write a character, and you don't have to write a character with motivations, or even figure out what those motivations are.
Yeah,
for people, there is no backstory almost to anybody. Everybody is just this vague symbol of a desire, of a want, of a social role. Whether it's the photographer that he's attracted to, his stodgy British boss who's so demanding.
Yeah.
Or the dad who's just like, I would hate any kid who liked my daughter. Yeah. And, like, you know, you needed to have that scene. So you also have that, like, weird thing about sexuality and, like, dads owning their daughter's sexuality.
Yeah.
Which is also beyond bizarre, but very American.
So we have to go back to that conversation. So... It's right after Nick has watched Darian undress. He's trying to get out of the house quickly, encounters the dad at the front door. The dad's like, why are you here? But he ends up helping the dad get all of the stuff up to the attic, and they're having this
conversation. And they learn about the carousel.
They learn about the carousel, and the dad mentions that Darian has really blossomed over the past year, and Nick's character's like, I noticed. Gross. Like that conversation was so gross. And then the dad takes a pair of pliers and insinuates, you know, snipping off a boy's balls or penis if he ever encounters his daughter. But there is, so Darian goes from 0 to 60 like that. And so if that's the case,
within I looked at the clock on the Laserdisc player, 14 minutes.
14
minutes to get to cringe in an 89-minute film.
And so there isn't also, you know, a sloppy shortcut would be in that while they're having that conversation about Darian, for the father to be like, you know, 2 years ago, Darian was in a mental hospital. She struggled with this. She's been doing much better now. There's no backstory or hint.
Not, and until the very end of the film, where the best friend insinuates that she might have killed her camp counselor, who she had
she might have poisoned him, yeah.
Yes.
A crush on as well. So
that she has, could not control.
that she could not control.
She's a monster. In a bikini. At 15. Oi. So the big five questions.
Yes.
Question one, I think we know, is a camp retro classic. Or just an old movie.
Just an old movie that aged poorly.
That wasn't good when it was new.
We should also mention it has like lifetime movie production
values. It has lifetime movie production values. But I mean, I remember this, you know, that cover that you'll see on our Instagram page. I remember seeing this. I never saw this film, but I was like, oh, the sunglasses and the red lipstick and oh, so dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just an old movie, which leads us to question two, the social political distance.
I mean, yeah, it's huge.
It's huge. It is also, I think, for me, a reminder of what was once acceptable. Mm-hmm. And we're Gen Xers. I love the 90s. I spend my time, actually, one of the things that makes this podcast work is that I keep 90s technology alive so that I can have CD players and Laserdisc players and cassette decks and all of these things in this house. And so I can listen to 90s music or listen to new music or even better, new music that sounds like 90s music. All of that, as smart and sophisticated and together as we thought we were then, that this could fly under some people's radar and that a public person could say, it's very sexy, this film. When you're talking about 15 years old Alicia Silverstone in her first major film. So wrong, so weird, so much cringe.
And we have to, like, you know, there is no exploration of power dynamics.
Yes.
No exploration of him.
Who's the adult? Who needs to have some self-control? Who needs to enforce boundaries? Who needs to do anything right or good or together or responsible?
I mean, the whole film is that bitch is crazy.
Yes. That's
really what that the film comes down to.
15-year-old sexy bitch is crazy.
Yep. And, you know, he... And there's no, and then also, like, the father, so once she does make the accusation, the father does try to attack Nick, and you're supposed to feel bad for Nick in this situation, but justifiably so, like,
he's a victim every time,
and he's 28, messing with a 14-year-old. Like, he literally was messing around with her. He was watching her.
Yes.
He definitely, the male gaze was all over the place with this. You saw all of that happening, and there was no critical discussion of how he was wrong and how he handled that relationship.
Yes. Question three, what about the technical distance from now to then? And I gotta say, computers are scary in this film.
Yes, yes.
The computer, you could just lose it. You can lose everything on your floppy disk. Yeah. And that, you know, this, like, chronic mistrust that things, like, he's a writer, he writes on a computer.
Yeah.
And he writes the big story, and of course she comes in her jealousy ruins the big story and erases everything because computers are scary. Exactly.
And younger kids know technology better than we do.
Yeah, which hasn't changed, but I think everybody else knows about cloud storage or something. You know what I mean? Like, just that.
I also think, well, So the most interesting thing about this movie is that her sunglasses are really cool, and his sunglasses are really cool.
He gets clip-ons as a gift.
As a gift.
Yeah. Question four, which is a new thing for us. What does it mean to watch this film on Laserdisc? Is there anything enhanced by... I think, again, that it's a rare disc that has the original name.
Right.
On a personal note, one of the reasons why I guess this podcast was maybe paused a little bit, or we got busy, but also we had problems with our Laserdisc player, which hopefully I have fixed it for the long term, and we can just put a Laserdisc in, and it'll just play a movie like it's supposed to, which actually was just a simple fix. The lens was dirty, and I cleaned the lens, and surprise, it works. But yeah, so I guess there is something about the physical media and watching this film. But the question five is then, will we ever watch this movie again?
No.
No.
No. It was a really, really... So not only is everything is wrong with this film. The story is cringe. Using a young Alicia Silverstone is cringe. And actually, this film is what got her the Aerosmith videos, which feels cringe.
Another layer. And so
those three Aerosmith videos, which led her to Clueless, which is what she's most famous for.
Yes.
But this, the story is just really wrong and off. The production values are really bad. The writer-director, Alan Shapiro, being stupid enough to use the real girl's name, but taking a crush and turning it into this film, is just weird. Everything related to this movie is just bizarre and strange and gross.
Yeah, so even if we, like, sold it back to the exchange, it would just end up in the hands of a creep. Like, somebody might be like, oh, you know.
Well, and I think that's probably why people... So it did... I think it cost $6 million, and it did make $13 million. And it's probably because people saw those Aerosmith videos and went back to see this film with her in it. I was the one who purchased it.
Yes, because it was 90s nostalgia, and we didn't know better.
It was 90s nostalgia. I thought it was just going to be, like, a cheesy horror film.
Yeah.
That's really what I was hoping for. I love me some cheese in my horror films. But it was definitely not a cheesy horror film. It was a poorly executed thriller that has... Oh, I should also mention, he also did, like, Disney films and stuff like that before this film.
Whoa!
So this guy is this very...
He says it keeps getting worse!
It just keeps getting worse.
How in the last, like, 2 minutes of this podcast can it keep getting worse?
I looked up Alan Shapiro just because I was like, I hope he hasn't worked since here.
Yeah.
Because actually, he doesn't... If you go to Wikipedia, like, his name does not light up at all.
Wow.
And yeah, it looks like he didn't have much of a career beyond, like, he did some directing and producing and things like that, but he didn't have a big career. But if I remember reading correctly, he did, like, some Disney films and stuff like that.
Ooh.
So he went, so he went from that
so
to
wrong,
this.
So bad, so weird.
100%. 100% weird.
This almost makes me wonder, you know, can you fit a Laserdisc in the microwave? Like, maybe that's the fate of this thing.
Well, I feel like we should probably, write a note and slip it inside. So we'll probably, we'll live somewhere in our basement. We should probably put a note inside saying we didn't know what we bought. We are not these people.
Well, you know, I in my academic life, I'm working on a book project that deals with white nationalism. So there's some things in this house that are here for research purposes. Yeah, the crush might just be there too.
So, yeah. So let me. I should just mention this. And so this is from IMDb. So he wrote and directed for Disney, and produced for Disney. And also, it looks like he worked with The Outsiders, was a producer for The Outsiders, and then he did this. So there's also a whole weird thing. And his film after that was Flipper.
What?
He's just like a weird dude. Yeah, he was the screenwriter for Flipper. He worked on the Outsiders TV series. He did a movie called The Christmas Star, Tiger Town. Yeah, so he... Right?
Not good.
Not good.
This movie's not good.
Not, no. So don't see it.
Don't watch it.
It's
we watched it for you. We took the hit for you.
And
we're,
you know,
out here doing the work. We took it. We took the hit for you, folks. Don't.
And for all of us,
and don't spend $10 on this.
You love Wesley Carey Elway's character in The Princess Bride, and you're like, oh, but it's got him in it. Don't fall for the trap.
It'll ruin it.
Don't do it.
It'll ruin Princess Bride for you.
It will.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll try to do this more regularly again, maybe for a while, until life happens. But hey, the Laserdisc player works. We watched a movie on it.
Woohoo!
Bye.
Bye.